Hello and welcome back to Tip TV Finance with me, Matt Brown, and I'm joined down the line by Callum Pickering, who is a senior UK economist at Berenberg. Good morning to you, Callum.
Good morning, Matt. Good morning.
Well, let's start off. Obviously, last week, the triggering of Article 50, so begins a year or two of negotiations. Now, how do you see this playing out for, well, both parties, both the UK and Europe?
Well, let's be clear. Those 2 years are just to negotiate the divorce. It's highly unlikely that there will be agreed a trade deal afterwards within those 2 years. So what's likely to happen is the UK and the EU will spend, say, the first 12 months negotiating the Brexit divorce. That's how much the UK owes the EU, the division of assets, the rights of citizens and so forth. And then they'll establish a broad framework for the negotiations for post-Brexit trade. So what will happen then is they'll probably agree on some transitional period. It may be, say, 3 to 5 years. And then during that transitional period, the UK and the EU will set out the details for post-Brexit trade. So de facto, during the two-year negotiation plus the transitional period, the UK is de facto back, still inside the EU, under the courts of the European Union, keeping to free movement of people, paying into the EU budget and enjoying all the benefits of a market member. So the actual Brexit may not happen, say, for 5 to 7 years. In my base case, the UK and the EU can agree to a deal that covers most goods and some services. In exchange, the UK puts some modest restrictions on low-skilled migration. And in my base case, that doesn't really affect the EU economy long-term, but reduces UK trend growth from, say, 2.2 to 1.8%. That's my base case. Fairly optimistic the UK and the EU can agree to a fairly comprehensive trade arrangement. But unfortunately, I see some risks to the downside. The recipe is in place for a hard Brexit. If the EU27 are uncompromising, if Parliament see this as an opportunity for a power grab, if Theresa May decides that she sees it better that the UK really reduces migration a lot and is willing to pay the price in terms of economic growth and market access, these are the sorts of routes towards a hard Brexit. Again, not my base case, but the risks are abound.
And we're looking at kind of macro data coming out from the UK and Europe, and it all generally feels fairly positive. Certainly looking back a few years ago, it's much improved. Yeah. So could we have a case that if Britain negotiates a fairly advantageous deal, and Europe as well, that it will be positive for both economies?
Well, really, at the most it can be a zero-sum game, and the most likely chance is that it's a slight negative-sum game for the UK. But you make a very good point. These negotiations are starting against the best possible economic backdrop. I've never been worried too much about the near-term economic consequences for the UK. Really, what we were thinking about is whether or not there would be a short-term demand-side shock. That hasn't happened simply because households are actually pretty robust in the UK. Balance sheets are strong enough to withstand a little uncertainty. That's why households have continued to spend, of course, with a little help from the Bank of England. But the long-term issue is mainly a supply-side issue. So again, there's no reason why a demand-side shock in the short term should have any real link to the long-term supply-side issues. But both the UK and the EU are now enjoying a broad-based expansion from both domestic demand rising and external demand rising, helped by the cyclical upturn in global demand. In the UK, it's a broad-based recovery. It will take a bigger shock than, say, 3% inflation this year to throw consumers off course. In the EU, in the Eurozone in particular, helped by loose monetary policy by the ECB, helped by the fact that austerity is over, the expansion is now broad-based and all components of demand are contributing to growth, domestic demand, external demand. It will take more than, say, we saw in 2011, worries in tiny Greece for us to start worrying about recession risks in Europe. No. And when we think about the major political risk in the Eurozone this year, of course, it's the French elections. Again, we must remember it's going against a solid economic backdrop, and that the most likely scenario is that Macron wins and not Le Pen, that France may actually have a reformer behind the wheel, actually supports economic confidence in the Eurozone and in across Europe.
And against that positive backdrop of economic data in Europe, you mentioned the ECB and potentially loosening of its policy or not tightening its policy. do you see any withdrawal of QE from the ECB or even rate hikes similar to the US in the forthcoming 12 mm-hmm. months to a year, 12 months to 24 months?
No, not really. I don't see why the ECB should change course at all. The best way to think about the Eurozone recovery versus, say, the US and the UK is, in employment terms, it's some 2 to 3 years behind. So crucially, the labour market conditions are not yet in place across the Eurozone for the Eurozone rate of inflation to sustain just under 2%, which is the ECB's target. We saw a little uptick in inflation at the beginning of the year, but that was mostly due to transitory factors, such as the washing out of past increases in oil prices and also some one-off issues in Southern Europe with food imports. Prices went up just for a couple months temporarily. Now inflation in the Eurozone is starting to trend down. The key component of inflation you'd focus on in the Eurozone when you're thinking about the ECB is core inflation. Mm-hmm. And it's still below 1% where it was almost a year ago. And it's only in our forecasts that we have core inflation ticking up across the Eurozone in the next 12 months. So my base case is a gradual recovery across the Eurozone in line or a little above its trend rate of growth, which is around, say, 1.5%, continued gains in employment and improvements in broad-based credit measures. But with that backdrop of weak inflation, the ECB can afford to go slow. They'll probably continue to buy at 60 billion per month their QE program for the rest of the year, phasing out in 2018 with the last purchases, say, in mid-2018. And it probably won't be until, say, Q3 2019 when the ECB hikes for the first time. My guess is that if he could, Mario Draghi would try to raise interest rates just to get the boat pointing in the right direction, even if only just to avoid him leaving and then having to pick up the newspaper and see that the title which says it took a German at the ECB to finally raise interest rates.
Fantastic. That's a good note to end on there. Callum Pickering from Berenberg, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.